Clause number 13-235-09-CR, the State of Texas versus Amanda McDonald.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. When Ms. McDonald was interviewed in 2018 in her home by officers from the San Antonio Police Department, she did not have a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Here specifically, there were proceedings in 2008. She was charged with intoxication manslaughter and failure to stop and render aid, or rather, she was arrested for those offenses. Those offenses were taken before a grand jury, and the grand jury no-billed them. That was back in 2008. And then the cases were dismissed at that time. So there were no proceedings against her. 10 years later, the same detective.
The right to Sixth Amendment isn't incumbent or imperative on a proceeding being pending before you.
Just
because you hadn't charged her or there was no pending charges doesn't trigger your Sixth Amendment right.
And so specifically here, the Sixth Amendment right would attach once she was taken before a magistrate. So she had a Sixth Amendment right back in 2007 when she was arrested, and that lasted until the case was taken to a grand jury and dismissed. I don't think that there's any dispute about that.
That time she was read her Miranda rights and did not waive them. Is that correct?
I don't know off the top of my head if the record reflects whether she waived her Miranda rights or not.
Let's assume she did not.
Sure.
I think that's what the record. I know that our record's a little lax on this one as compared to some of the old ones. And she did have a retained lawyer.
That's correct.
So both those things still existed in 2016.
18.
I mean,
so,
18. Is
so,
it 18?
Well, yeah, it's 18, but their argument is that they
exactly.
Do not.
So, and I can appreciate your questions. The state's position is that under
Well,
fraud,
I'm just trying to get the facts right. I'm just
sure.
trying to figure out that that's what occurred. And then when they come talk to her, the detective, which is my understanding, has the old familiarity, knew that those facts occurred.
So it's the same detective. Now I believe he's a lieutenant. It's Lieutenant Sullivan. He was the original detective back in 2007 and 2008. And so he would have been the same detective then, and he was the same detective in charge of the case in 2018. It's the exact same detective. That's right.
Okay. That's just what I was trying to put in. Okay, proceed.
So what's at issue is whether that Sixth Amendment right to counsel lasts in perpetuity or whether the proceedings against her terminated that right. And the state's position is that under Frye and based on cases that interpret Frye, that Sixth Amendment right terminated after the case was no-billed and after the case was dismissed. That Sixth Amendment right was terminated. So in 2018, when officers or the detective...
You don't have case law supporting that proposition, do you?
So specifically, I would point to the language of Frye. What Frye holds, and I'm looking at the Penn site is 329. Their holding is that we therefore find that even though the dismissal of the misdemeanor information and complaint altered the positions of the parties, such dismissal was accomplished specifically for the purpose of conducting a continuing investigation, including this transaction. And there are subsequent cases which the state has cited in its brief that point out this Sixth Amendment right doesn't last in perpetuity. And in fact, what Frye suggests is they actually say under the unique circumstances of this case, we hold the Sixth Amendment right still applies. That's Frye. Frye is factually distinguishable in that the case was dismissed for continuing to investigate it. And then members of...
But isn't this, in essence, a continuing investigation? I think that the lieutenant in this case wasn't satisfied that she wasn't charged back in 2007 and decided to go talk to her and try to get more information out of her. So he was investigating.
So I think what's important here is that in Frye, it was dismissed for the purpose of continuing the investigation. That was actually noted by Frye, one of the reasons for the dismissal. And there actually members of the district attorney's office, whether it's an attorney or whether it's one of their interns, began questioning the defendant very soon after, within months. They actually call up the defendant and then begin asking him questions. And there he references the fact that he has an attorney. But they continue asking questions. And I'll point out one of them is actually an attorney who represented the county there. And he testified, well, I know that he said that he had an attorney, but I didn't think he was telling the truth, essentially. So what Fry says in footnote three is that doesn't matter. Footnote three says whether or not the state actually believes a defendant to be represented by a particular attorney is irrelevant. Rather, the issue is whether a Sixth Amendment right to counsel was implicated and invoked, and if so, whether the state violated that right by contacting the appellee. Obviously, I concede in Fry, in that case, that the Court of Criminal Appeals held that. The Court of Criminal Appeals held that there was a Sixth Amendment violation. The state's position, though, is that was a holding that was unique to the facts, and that is elaborated on by cases that cite Fry. There's actually not a lot of cases that cite Fry. When I got on Westlaw and searched for any cases citing particular headnotes in Fry, one of the headnotes had 11 cases citing it, another one had 17. Those are headnotes that are relevant to this issue. So it's not a very common. Not a very commonly cited case. And a lot of cases that cite it may cite it in passing. So the state has provided a number of cases that are, admittedly, they're from other places, they're persuasive authority that they're going to expand upon what Fry analyzes, essentially, that this is not a right that lasts in perpetuity.
But I think you're asking this court to draw some kind of line. And the question is, how do we draw that line? Where do we draw it? I think you're arguing that once she was no-billed, then that's it.
And I have
She
two
lost the
answers.
right then.
So I have two responses for that. And one is that under the facts of this case, when she was interviewed 10 years later, at some point prior to that, that right had certainly extinguished. What I think Fry and cases that cite Fry suggest is that that right ceases once the proceedings against her have terminated, specifically here, a no-bill and a dismissal. But Fry creates an exception
But
where
how
if
are you
that
defining proceedings? Because
Right.
obviously the case didn't go away. And her lawyer told her, look, the case is not going away. There's no statute of limitations. So, I mean, obviously there's still a proceeding out there.
And I think here it was specifically that there was an indictment against her. What I would point to is one of the cases that we cite in our brief is Sims. I think this one factually is very much on point. In Sims, the defendant there, it's a West Virginia case, but the defendant there was charged with arson. The case was, I believe, dismissed because a judge found that there was no probable cause. About 2 years later, an informant comes to the law enforcement in West Virginia with information on the case. And there, the authorities there actually proceed to re-interview her without counsel. And the West Virginia court held that that was not a violation. And they looked to Fry, pointing out essentially that that case was unique to its circumstances. So, although it's
It
persuasive
looks
authority,
like, at least what I can derive from Fry and some of the other cases you cite in, it's almost a case by case review, factually. And one of the things, however, that struck me and that the chief just spoke about is that when this officer, who's the same officer from the previous, went with the intent to investigate and to get incriminating statements from her regarding the 2007. And so, if we are trying to figure out where we're going to draw the line as to where it ends, we need to look at what is being done by the state in order to protect the Sixth Amendment. And so, if the testimony is that he is there to investigate and to create an incrimination statement from the defendant, then doesn't that in itself say she's still protected under the Sixth Amendment? Do you understand my question? I
I
went
do
around in
understand.
circles.
I do understand. Yes, I do understand. I think here it doesn't matter, and I think that's what footnote three of Fry explicitly
You
suggests.
think once it's no-build, that's it?
I think that once it's no-billed, the proceedings against her have terminated, and that Fry creates an exception where if the dismissal was for the purpose of circumventing her Sixth Amendment right, I believe that's the test. And I think that's exactly what Sims holds as well, in interpreting Frye.
Let's
Again,
say that, but let's assume then, if you're right, there's no bill, she's not protected, then don't they have to follow the protection again? Is she in custody? Is she entitled to a Miranda rights? Does she have to be read her Miranda rights? Is she in their investigation? I mean, then it just starts all over, and at which time she could still be protected under the Sixth Amendment.
and so if I'm understanding your question right, the state's position here is that this was a non-custodial interrogation when it happened, when the interviews happened in 2018, and she didn't need to be read her Miranda rights then because it was a non-custodial interrogation, and because the proceedings against her had been terminated back in 2008.
Well,
So
counsel,
she
did
did
she?
talk.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Counsel, did she invoke her right to counsel when she said, I have an attorney?
Can I have one
So
more?
I
Yes.
so
I was looking for
sure.
that.
If I'm remembering the record correctly, she definitely references the fact that she had an attorney. My
She
understanding
said,
is
I don't
that
need to talk to you
to
without my
you,
lawyer. Not without
exactly.
my lawyer.
So my understanding of the case law as far as an invocation goes is an invocation to your lawyer needs to be clear and unambiguous. I think in this case, that wasn't the case.
You don't think her
But
saying, and this is the findings from the court, defendant states, I don't have to talk to you. She's walking away, and she can then be heard shouting from the hallway, not without my lawyer. You don't think that's equivocal? I'm not talking to you unless you got my lawyer here.
I think that is her referencing her attorney, obviously factually saying, I don't have to talk to you without my lawyer being present. I think that's distinguishable from her saying, I want my attorney here before answering any further questions. But at the
That's
end of the
really splitting
day,
hairs, sir. No,
well, but
I want my lawyer here. I want this lawyer here. I mean, the case law is
sure.
pretty clear about, the what you have to say, and there's no magic words.
There's no magic words. If I'm remembering correctly, I think one of the cases that talks about this is Davis, the Supreme Court case. I believe there the reference was maybe I should talk to an attorney. I think it's akin to that type of statement. That's what I would say.
Let me switch gears a little
But
bit here. Can we perhaps punt on this primary issue that's being raised and decide this case based on the officer's conduct alone? This seems to be there were some things said to her, like, we can't do anything about the alcohol. We can't do anything of what happened those years ago. You're not in trouble. There seem to be some statements that are a little questionable that we have to consider.
so I presume you're getting to the due process arguments that were put forth in opposing counsel's brief. The state's position there is that those comments would need to be something that overbore her will. I do think this is a case where the video speaks for itself, that although they're making some statements that are misleading, this is not something that rises to the level of a due process violation. The state's position is that truly here, what matters is whether she had a Sixth Amendment right to counsel, because if she has a Sixth Amendment right to counsel, I mean that's the end. But if there's no Sixth Amendment right to counsel, there's nothing for her to invoke, there's nothing for her to waive. That's the issue for this court to decide squarely. And as far as due process goes specifically too, I mean I think that one of the cases that counsel cites, Lopez, I think does a good job of analyzing that issue. There, they found that the defendants, or rather the law enforcement's actions, were not coercive. They didn't overbear the defendant's will there. There were some references. It was a murder case involving, or I don't know if it was a murder case, but it involved an 11-month-old deceased child that was in the defendant's custody. And there, in an interview, there were some references by the detectives. Basically, that he needed to confess because if they denied involvement, they could arrest him and his wife. They could let the court sort it out, and then if that happened, the kids could go into foster care. There, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that wasn't a type of threat or statement that rose to that level of a due process violation. And I think if that's something that doesn't rise to the level of a due process violation, our case certainly isn't when you're looking at a video which I think speaks for itself that her will was not overborne. I think really the issue here is whether she had a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And that's it.
What was that case that you just cited? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So that is Lopez versus State. The quote that I read out, the citation is 610 Southwest 3rd, 487. The Penn site there is 497. And I believe I'm out of time. With
I
that, I
just have
will
one quick question
reserve. Of
for you.
course.
So, speaking of Miranda, case law is clear. Had she been administered Miranda warnings in 2018, and I know she wasn't, but had she would have to had clearly waived her right then, unequivocally. I believe the record reflects that she was administered Miranda warnings in 2007.
I believe the
Did
record
those
reflects.
expire?
Yes.
Does that warning expire, or does it technically carry forward to 2018?
The state's position is that that would have terminated.
That
It
terminated.
was this was a non-custodial interrogation in our case.
So
With
it
that,
goes from interrogation to interrogation that warnings have to be readministered if they're going to be.
in this case, if she was in a custodial interrogation, they would have had to read her Miranda rights. With that, I'll
But
reserve the
I think
remainder
that I'm
for.
not, I'm making sure I answer it. So if she was read her Miranda rights and did not waive them in 2007 or 8, do those then also terminate just like your Sixth Amendment? I mean, if she'd already had signed a document that says, I'm not talking to y'all unless I have my lawyer present and I don't waive them, do those not also still exist in 2018?
I don't believe so. That might be something that I need to follow up with a letter to the court with, providing some kind of cases. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
Please do so.
Thank
Thank you,
you.
Your Honors.
Unless the counsel for Appalachia can answer the question. Unless counsel, you can answer
Oh,
the
well, indeed. May it please the court. My name is Dean Dyson, and with Stephen Gilmore, we represent the appellee in this case. Specifically with respect to whether or not any sort of waiver of the right to counsel would have carried forward from 2007. My understanding is that they did attempt to, after they filed a criminal complaint, they did attempt to interview her, and she invoked her right to counsel at that point. So there was no incriminating statements given in 2007. There's no statements at all
Right.
from
Does that
2007.
terminate them, or does that continue to exist in perpetuity? Once she asks for right to counsel arising, I know that when they're investigated about a different incident, you have to the Mirandas don't go, like, they're talking to them about something else. But in this case, since she had already given her right to counsel in
The case
2007.
law says you can invoke it one of two ways, either through an explicit request during a pretrial proceeding, either by a request during formal interrogation, or by simply hiring counsel. And in Frye, the CCA found that
And
the
that just
defendant,
exists for as long as whatever may be going along with that
it was found to be
investigation.
violated in Frye. The right to counsel was found to be violated 6 months after a judge signed a dismissal in that case. And we'll talk about Frye in just a minute. I want to just begin by saying that I think that there are forces in our society that are actively seeking to concentrate power in the executive branch. And the impulses that drive those efforts are plain if we simply sit down and watch the evening news or see any of the myriad of attack ads that demonize the status quo or seek to denounce the enemy within. And if those forces are successful, the increase in executive power that results will come at the expense of the other co-equal branches of government, our legislatures, the judiciary, and the people. This case involves a question of first impression that involves just such a power grab. The state claims that they and they alone should be able to get to decide not only when the right to counsel attaches, but also when it detaches. Now, attachment is unavoidable. They get to determine when a criminal complaint is filed. They get to determine when somebody gets marched before a magistrate. That's when the right attaches. That's when the interests of the parties become solidly adverse with respect to a specific charge. But it's also worth noting that in this case, as in most, and I believe touched on this, magistration occurs well before any type of formal charging instrument is filed. And so that right attaches not when a formal prosecution begins, but when magistration occurs. Okay? So it cannot be said that a person's right to counsel somehow depends on the pendency of formal charges. It's not
thing does not necessarily follow the other, nor can it be denied that the right to counsel continues at all criminal stages, not of a formal prosecution or formal charges are pending, but rather during a criminal proceeding. And
so then the question is, did the proceedings end after she was no-billed?
Well, Montejo makes very clear that interrogation after the right attaches, just sometime thereafter, the interrogation is a critical stage of a criminal proceeding. Okay? It doesn't require that formal charges be pending at the time. But the real paragraph
regardless of how long after they occur.
Well, there are going to be some events whereby the right to counsel terminates. You know, if the parties themselves dissolve the attorney-client relationship, or one of those parties dies, or a statute runs, or use immunity is granted, one of those things like that might terminate the right to counsel. But of course, none of that happened here. The real paragraph that I see here is that the state is also now trying to claim for the first time ever in Texas that they have the right unilaterally to determine when the right terminates. But they're light on the details of what has to happen in order for that termination to occur. Is it simply the no bill? I would say no. They had the right to go to grand juries multiple times based on the same criminal complaint. They did. This case shows that they went to a grand jury not once, but twice on the same criminal complaint. And it was no-billed. And I will also like to note that there was no dismissal in this case. A dismissal is a term of art. A dismissal is something that the state has to go and ask a judge for after the court's jurisdiction has been invoked. No formal charging instrument was ever filed in this case. No jurisdiction was ever invoked. There was no dismissal.
And dismissal is important because once you're dismissed, then they can't charge.
Well, there might be an argument that a formal dismissal terminates the right to counsel.
Because if you dismiss, would there be, going back to the first argument, then if almost an acquittal and you would be almost trying to double charge if they formally dismiss it? I mean, I'm just trying to think, you know, if we're trying to figure out at what proceeding this terminates, could a dismissal be one?
Well, that would be a question left for a different day, under different facts, where dismissal actually occurred. And because we don't have that here, I don't know that we would need to reach that question. At best, the charges were simply rejected for further investigation, no different than in Frye. The only difference is that the case for which there was a charging instrument filed in Frye was a misdemeanor, so they didn't need a grand jury in order to invoke the trial court's jurisdiction, but they did need to go to the judge to get a dismissal signed, and that happened here. But the underlying cause for things falling apart in both Frye and here are exactly the same, which is to say some type of evidentiary hole existed that they needed to shore up in order to get a felony indictment. And in order to shore that up, it required a further investigation. So the purposes being achieved there were absolutely the same in both Frye and here. And to suggest somehow that the party's positions did not remain solidly adverse ever since this appellee, was first marched before a magistrate in 2007 is, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but I find it to be legal fiction. The parties' positions were just as solidly adverse for these exact same charges on August 19th, 2018, as they were when the appellant was first taken before a magistrate for these same charges back in September and December of 2007. The two big cases that we've directed the court's attention to are, of course, Frye and Lujan. In Frye, a dismissal with prejudice was ordered, not simply because of the timing of the interrogation that occurred there, which I might add happened fully 6 months after a judge signed a dismissal in that case.
Do you think that time is an issue? It seems to, the state seemed to argue here this morning that it was 6 months in Frye, and so the time issue is different than here that we have 10 years.
So when did it terminate here? At 1 year, 2 years?
I don't know.
The state's real light on what sort of conduct has to occur in order for them to unilaterally be able to say that the right terminates. But they are, so they make no mistake, they're claiming that right for themselves. Again, The state doesn't say, and I would suggest that that's a question that should be asked to them. When exactly did it terminate? Counsel for the state said it to no bail, but that can't be true because they went to the grand jury on that same criminal complaint more than once. So it can't just be a no bail. They have to do something more to destroy that right. The result in Frye also was not due simply to the reason admitted there for the dismissal, which is the need for further investigation, although that need was still robust and equally present here. What caused a dismissal with prejudice in Frye were the investigative methods that were used. State investigators, 6 months after dismissal, called the defendant, told them a lie about what the purpose of the interrogation was for. They claimed that the complainant in that case was now worried that perhaps they were in the wrong in that case, and that therefore any purpose of questioning their target was to not only absolve him, but to perhaps, you know, confirm or deny whether or not it was the other party who was in the wrong in that case. They lied to him, in essence, about what they planned to use or what they planned to do with the statements that they were gathering. And the Court of Criminal Appeals didn't like it. Similar question happened here, and we'll get to that in a minute. Likewise, in State v. Lujan, and again, this was a question that one of the panel members put the state's attorneys on. What about the methods used there? Suppression was ruled the correct remedy because the defendant had been misled that a particular statement of three that they gathered on the same day was not going to be used against her. And so all at all levels of judicial review, trial, intermediate appellate court, and CCA, they agreed that the statements in which the defendant had been misled should be suppressed. And with that, I'd like to note that there is an error in my brief on page 32, where I write something to the effect of false promises made during interrogation, including misleading suggestions that evidence gathered will not be used against the person, violate Article 3822 only if they cause statements that are untruthful. Article 3822, of course, is the codification of the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. And just because there isn't a similar Sixth Amendment codification doesn't mean Sixth Amendment right to counsel is somehow less robust.
Let me ask you a question going back to the Sixth Amendment. So you heard, trying to find my notes here, that the her request for counsel are mentioning that she has a lawyer during the interrogation was not clear and unambiguous, is what the state is arguing.
Well, there's case law cited in the brief that said that a defendant who in that particular instance was in custody, so of course it was the Fifth Amendment right, not the Sixth Amendment right, invoked counsel by saying, I don't want to waive no right, not unless I have a counsel. I don't know how that's functional any different than saying, I don't need to talk to you, not without my lawyer. I think the appellee's expert adversaries knew what she was saying. Okay, so I would argue that what she did was sufficient to invoke that right, even on October 19, 2018.
Okay, so taking that a step further, does she then waive it? Because then, according to the findings from the court, she then opens the back door and tells Detective Gooden that he can come outside and talk to her, but not Lieutenant Sullivan. And she begins to talking to Detective Goodwin. Does she invoke her right and then waive it immediately thereafter by talking to Detective Goodwin?
Respectfully, Judge, I would say it doesn't matter in this case because we're the appellee. A suppression ruling can be affirmed on any ground that finds support in the record, but it can only be reversed on a ground that was squarely placed before the trial court. The state never argued that below. It's been waived.
The waiver's been waived.
A waiver happens expressly. A forfeiture happens by inaction.
Okay.
There was inaction below, so that issue is just not available. Further, I would submit that there's a huge difference between lies about evidentiary matters, you know, claiming that your co-defendant is singing in the cubicle next door when that's false, or we found your DNA at the crime scene when that's false, if telling the defendant that leads to a truthful statement. But when you tell or mislead, a person that we can't use adverse driving facts against you. And then you turn around and try and use adverse driving facts against them. That is a fundamentally different type of lie. That's the type of lie that was in present in Lujan. And my point to you is in pointing out the error in my brief, is that they never once touched on in Lujan this notion that, oh yeah, by the way, but what they went fishing for were ended up being truthful statements. It was irrelevant. It was the nature of the lie that caused the exclusion. And we have very similar misleading statements here. You know, they first tell her, not 2 minutes into the door, you're not in any trouble. And if you were drunk when you drove that night, I can't do anything about that. So either way, that's irregardless to me. And to be honest with you, there is nothing I can do about the alcohol in your system all these years later. Well, they're going to tell her that to get her to talk. They should be held to those statements. Respectfully.
I'll ask you the same question I asked the state. Could we sidestep the Sixth Amendment issue and decide the case? If we agree with you on the 14th Amendment issue, could we decide the case alone?
Due process alone. You wouldn't even need to touch on the Sixth Amendment issue if you find a due process violation. There's a case in the paper that says that promises can be sufficiently coercive to overcome a defendant's will. Or a target's will, who's being interrogated, and in that case, the interrogators told a mother that they wouldn't take her kids away if she confessed, and they found that that promise was sufficient to create a due process violation, and I don't know that they made any type of different promises here. They said that if you were drunk when you drove that night, I can't do anything about that. You're not in any trouble. And to be honest with you, there's nothing I can do about the alcohol in your system all these years later. And that is not to say that there aren't any limits on the right to counsel. Again, if there's a voluntary termination between the attorney and the client, or one of them dies, or the statute runs, that would be one thing. The other thing there's adequate prophylactics in place here is that in Montejo, the U.S. Supreme Court held that uncounseled waivers of the right to counsel, uncounseled waivers can be valid so long as they're Brandeis first. Right? If this thing falls apart, the state's interrogators have nobody to blame but themselves.
So the case law makes a huge difference between investigation, interrogation, and at one point you're entitled to counsel. Do you believe that at any point this becomes interrogation and she needs to be remirandized remirandized?
Well, if we do reach the Sixth Amendment question and she still had that right, the only way that it could be effectively waived is if she was Mirandized first. The Fifth Amendment right to counsel and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel are waived in exactly the same manner. And that's through, they have to be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And, Judge Scalia says that reading Miranda warnings typically does the trick.
But did the reading of the Miranda warnings in 2007 still hold in 2018?
There were no Miranda warnings, as far as I know, given in 2007.
The record said there were.
They tried to interrogate her then, and she begged off, said, I've got counsel, and that ended that.
I see.
So they didn't actually waive them. Yeah,
okay.
Me too.
I see.
Yes, no, there was no statements at issue here date back to 2000.
So there's no written waiver of her Miranda rights in any way?
No point.
Or even given of her Miranda rights?
Right.
She immediately invoked her right to counsel in 2007.
Wisely in 2007. In my opinion, did the same thing in 2018 and then was fed lies and she talked.
And here we are.
Here we are. The detectives here could have reached out to someone in the district attorney's office and say, look, how do we do this right? Record makes clear they reached out to nobody. They could have called defense counsel first and maybe have been told, yeah, the money's run out. I don't represent her anymore. They didn't even try. The court found the officer Solon's testimony on this point to be disingenuous, which is supported by the record. Of course, he called nobody at the house to let them know that he had these new interrogative intentions in mind. I'll leave you two parting thoughts. Even though we're the appellee here, we very much come here with our hat in our hands. When the state's PDRs, I've already been told by the state's attorneys, not once but twice, once in an email, once in the elevator, that this is all just kind of preliminary, that whoever loses here is going to fight on. I take them at their word. I have no reason to doubt them. But when the state's PDRs get filed, they get granted at a clip of about 50%. When a defendant's PDR goes up, it stands about a 7% chance. So I'm going to implore you, please, just leave the status quo as it is. And if we have to go fight in Austin, I welcome that opportunity. Finally, given the egregiously deceptive and unwarranted assertions the police made during a critical questioning of an unaided layperson on August 19, 2018, we respectfully submit that the suppression ruling reached below should be affirmed. And I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Unless there's questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
May it please the court. So something I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but the state's submitting to you here that what is at issue is whether or not she had a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And the state's position is that here she did not have a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. There was nothing to waive. As they stated, we waive the waiver issue, if you will. What we have to address here is whether or not she had a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. There's a couple of factual things that I noticed that I want to address. One is that in the findings of fact, it does say in the record that there was a custodial arrest in 2007 and that she was Mirandized. And I believe that is Lieutenant Sullivan's testimony. so it is in the trial court's, or okay. Yes, the trial court's findings of fact. The second one is that number 21 in their findings of fact, they do note that the defendant was not in custody at the time. I know that I said earlier that I didn't think Miranda applied, that it's per custody. I stand by that, and I'm happy to submit some cases if needed. I don't believe any prior invocation of Miranda would control in this case. So separately, I want to address a couple of the factual components about the proceedings against her. I think that it's important that Lieutenant Sullivan, although he was the original detective back then, the testimony reflects that he was actually transferred out of the unit. And it wasn't until much later that he's actually transferred back into traffic's investigation. So I think factually here, it's important to say there absolutely were no proceedings against her. The detective had been moved out. He's not working on investigating it. Obviously, he takes his initiative and he begins reinvestigating it. But I think that's a factual, something that's factually important as far as whether there are proceedings against her or not. I'll circle back to it too, though. The state's position is that the proceedings against her terminated when the case was no-billed and it was dismissed. And I believe that there was actually a dismissal.
Reactivate or resurface, whatever word you want to use, when he decided to continue the investigation.
Can you say that again?
Did the proceedings basically, you know, resume when he decided to continue with the investigation?
So the second time around, the proceedings did not resume until she was arrested and then magistrated on that offense. So the state's position is the proceedings against her. There were no proceedings against her when she was re-interviewed in 2018.
Seems like you're wanting to treat these like two different incidents, and they're not. It's the same incident, and that's what's been a little troublesome here.
Sure, and I think that some of the case law that we cite, it expands upon that. So Sims, I know I talked about it a couple times, but that's exactly what happened in Sims. It was an arson case. A judge found there's no probable cause. Later, they get more information. They go back and re-interview them, and that's what Sims found. And actually, I'll quote that briefly. Here, the citation would be 515 Southeast 2nd 582. What Sims holds in that case, where it was an arson charge, where they re-interview her 2 years after the dismissal, they say, we hold that unless a criminal defendant can show the government has obtained a dismissal of adversarial judicial criminal proceedings against him or her, in order to circumvent his or her constitutional rights. Once such criminal proceedings have been dismissed, the right to the assistance of counsel granted by the Sixth Amendment to the United States of the Constitution no longer applies, regardless of whether the defendant is represented by counsel.
What state is that out of?
That's out of West Virginia. Okay.
That's what I thought. So do we know what, because every state uses things differently, what do they mean in that state when they talk about getting a dismissal? Do you know?
That I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
That's where, you know, words are important.
Sure.
And there they seem to hinge themselves on the dismissal, which creates an adverse scenario. Well, here we don't have a dismissal. It's a no bill. And that, as we know, is very different from a dismissal.
In my understanding is that there was a no bill and there was a dismissal because she was arrested. I don't believe that she is relieved of her bond until the state also submits a dismissal. That's my understanding. It may be in the trial court's findings of facts and conclusions of law. I'm not sure off the top of my head. But I think going back to Sims, ultimately it's talking about the same Sixth Amendment, and the cases that we cite, they're talking about the same Sixth Amendment. There's no Sixth Amendment right to counsel here. And with that, I will, I have no time left, but thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be under submission.